When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Welcome to Let It Roll, the insanely ambitious musical history podcast hosted by Nate Wilcox. We've covered the early history of rock and roll, country music in the 20th century, the rise of hip-hop, disco, electronic dance music, and heavy metal. Stay tuned for our histories of Broadway, opera, punk rock, jazz, blues, ragtime, Latin music, and gospel. Follow the Let It Roll podcast on Twitter at Let It Rollcast, and check out our brand new Substack newsletter and website at letitrollpodcast.com. We've got archives of every episode sorted by genre, era, guest, co-host, and mini-series. It's also a great way to support the show if you can afford it. Let It Roll is a Pantheon podcast, and you can listen to more great podcasts at www.pantheonpodcasts.com. Today, Nate welcomes Peter Benjaminson to discuss his book, The Lost Supreme, The Life of Dreamgirl Florence Ballard, which kicks off a special Let Motown Roll miniseries. Email us at letitrollpodcast@gmail.com. Pop in those earbuds and enjoy.
It's time to let it roll. I'm your host, Nate Wilcox, and today we're joined by Peter Benjaminson to discuss his book, The Lost Supreme, The Life of Dreamgirl Florence Ballard. Peter, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Thanks for inviting me.
And I got to warn our listeners, this is possibly going to be one of the most depressing and sad episodes we ever do. And there's sexual assault and exploitation. And so, you know, if you're not ready for that, you might want to back out now. This is a heavy tale, and Peter's book pulls no punches. So, Peter, at first, tell us how the book came about and how you, because you had some unique access to Ms. Ballard before she passed.
Yes, well, I was a reporter for the Detroit Free Press in 1975. I was sitting in the newsroom, and one of the editors came over, John Opendahl, and he looked very excited. He told me that he just heard that a former Supreme was on welfare. This was a big deal in Detroit in 75 because Motown was still a dominant record company. It was a Detroit company, and for a member of their all-time greatest group to be on welfare was really something. So I immediately jumped up, grabbed a Free Press staff car, roared out to Flo's house. I had her address. She lived in Detroit, as I did, and went in, and actually I knocked on the door. She wasn't there. There was no answer. So I waited about 20 minutes. She came back with her two daughters in tow from grocery shopping. And I went in and interviewed her. I told her I knew she was on welfare. She knew I knew. So the interview went from there.
And then that turned into a series of interviews, correct?
Yes. Well, thank you. The interview was only about, 45 minutes at the most, because I was on deadline for the Free Press, which was the daily. It was the morning daily in Detroit. So I took my notes, which were just on a notepad, rushed back to the office and wrote a story, which the next day was on the front page, Supreme on welfare. this inaugurated a tremendous amount of public interest because, you know, everybody figured she was in the number one group in the world only a couple of years before. And suddenly she was on Aid to Dependent Children, which was the big welfare program of the day, certainly in Detroit. So what was she doing there? And the Detroit News, which is a competition, sent several reporters out to interview her, and other newspaper and TV stations were interviewing her. So it became a really big deal. So she called me up, and you know, she'd been a little worried about the story, the story's possibly making her look like an idiot for being, you know, famous and now on welfare. But they didn't. They treated her sympathetically. Mine did too. So she invited me back to her house for a series of tape-recorded interviews. Her idea was that we could jointly write a book about her life, you know, from the bottom, then to the top, and then back to the bottom in just a few years. And it would sell very well. She was right. And I went ahead and wrote the book
long after she passed. And you had a difficulty getting it published. It didn't come out until decades after those interviews, correct?
Oh, yes, that's true. I'm sorry. I should have said that. from this perspective of my extreme old age, I look back on it. It seems like just a few minutes. But yes, I interviewed her. I did the transcript. And then I tried to sell it to various publishers. With a fellow reporter at the Free Press, I had already done one book. It was called Investigative Reporting. It was the first textbook in the field. It came out right after the Watergate triumph, and it was very, very popular. So I got access to a lot of publishers. I told them I wanted to do the Flo Ballard book, but there was really no interest. I had a interview in New York. I think it was with Random House, or one of those big publishers. And a young lady editor took me out to dinner, and I was ready for her big offer. But she said, you know, what we really like is a book on Janis Joplin. Now that turned out to be astute on her part, because although Joplin had died in 1970, there have since been at least five books about her, and they've all sold well. I mean, I love Janis as a singer. I never met her, but I don't really know what the total attraction is. Maybe a depressed white woman or something. Anyway, the books have done well, but I stuck to my guns. I said, nah, or I didn't say nah. I said, no, I don't think so. I've got this unique transcript from Flo Ballard, and I'd really like to write a book about her. But they turned me down. So, then I think while I was there trying to sell the book, this is about a year after the interview, Flo died at age 32. This was, amazingly young to die. She had no apparent health problems, and it's still a slight mystery as to what killed her. They did an autopsy, but there was nothing special. I mean, she died of some kind of heart problem, but there, you know, people were talking about possible drug use or alcohol, but she didn't use any drugs, and she quit alcohol. She did have an alcohol problem previously, but she quit a long time ago. So it was a fairly mysterious death. And I thought, now's my chance. She's dead. And there was a huge funeral that Diana Ross appeared at. I was there too. And, you know, hundreds of people were there, and a crowd tore. It was a big funeral with lots of floral arrangements, lots of mourners. A crowd tore apart the flower arrangements, just trying to get souvenirs of the death of the Law Supreme. Once again, I thought, geez, I should be able to, you know, now that she's dead, I should be able to sell this book. So I went back to New York and went to Grove Press and gave them a whole pitch for how a book on the Law Supreme would be so great. And they said, but you know, there's never been a book on the Motown Record Company. You're pushing too far ahead. So I said, how would you like to write a book on the Motown Record Company? By this time, I'd become frustrated, you know, with trying to sell a Flo Ballard book. And this was Barney Rossett, who was a very famous publisher. He asked me personally if I could write a book, the first book ever published in the U.S. on the Motown Record Company. And I said, okay, fine. You know, we signed a deal. I then spent a couple of years writing the book. It came out. It was a big success. The Story of Motown, Grove Press published it in, I believe, 79. And it was.
It's a classic.
Say again.
It's a classic, one I've read many times.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, really. It's the first book, and I interviewed a lot of people. Motown made a mistake at the time. They had a very stupid PR man, Crook, who's now dead. And I went out there and said, look, I'm very friendly to Motown. You know, I just want to do the true story. So I flew out. I was living in Miami at the time. I flew out to Los Angeles and to see Motown. That's where they had moved. I said, look, I just want to do a true book about Motown. You know, I don't have any access to Grind, and it'll just be a fair story. Everything on both sides. You can contribute anything you want. He said, absolutely not. We're not going to let you talk to anybody, anyone who works for Motown. So I thought, what an idiot. Because then the only people that I could talk to were people who didn't like Motown, fired people, you know, executives who quit, stuff like that. But nevertheless, I did as fair a job as I could under the circumstances. And that book was so popular, it was republished in 2018, or maybe 2019, in the second edition by Rare Bird Books. It's still selling. You can buy it online. It's in various formats, including, you know, whatever they call a spoken word book online.
Audiobook.
Thank you. You know, now I'm going on so long, I forgot the question.
That's all right. It's time for me to jump in with a cue. Anyway, this is the Primettes, which was the Supremes before they were called the Supremes. This is a song called Pretty Baby with Flo Ballard on lead vocals. That was the Primettes, who became the Supremes, singing Pretty Baby with Flo Ballard on lead vocals. And now if you could give us a quick summary of just how big were the Supremes, how famous was Flo Ballard, and why was it such a shock when she ended up on welfare and then suddenly dying at age 32?
Well, let me first finish the other story and tell you that the book did eventually come out, but we can get back into that later. The big deal about the Supremes was that they integrated the American music business. The previous American music business, in terms of the most popular records, was mostly white. You know, How Much Is That Dog in the Window? I think there was Patti Page and
it was
Rock Hudson, or various people, all white guys and white women singing various songs. And then there was a sort of underground black stream of very funky rock and roll songs, but they were separate. People, you know, there were black record stores and white record stores, and that was it. The Supremes and Motown, under Gordy, who was a black guy, but very, very much into integration and making a lot of money, united the two streams of the Motown Record Company, which is located in Detroit. And that was a big deal. You know, he got black rhythm, white melody, and put them all together very astutely. People said he also had been an auto worker, like many people in Detroit, and he realized you had to have interchangeable parts, different vocalists, would be moved around between different composers, different instrumental players, you know, different producers. They were like wheels revolving until they found the right combination. And they found the right combination, the best of the right combination, with the Supremes. They were perfectly named, and Flo Ballard came up with the name because they became the world's most popular singing group for some time. They were certainly the world's most popular black singing group, black female singing group. They toured all over the world, Japan, England, many countries. It was basically the union of black and white music, which was, I think, a big, big deal in American music.
Yeah, they went toe-to-toe with the Beatles from 64 to 67 with 10 number one hits, including 5 in a row. And that was out of 14 singles they released in that period, and all 14 of them went top 10. An incredible run. And they're on the Ed Sullivan Show week in, week out, just an absolute triumph and unique in American history up to that point. Like you said, this is the first time that black performers are competing on the level. And the Beatles were an unprecedented pop phenomenon. And for a black girl group from Detroit, you know, the Beatles annihilated much of the American pop industry. And the Supremes were unbowed and went toe-to-toe with them, with Holland Dozier Holland as the brilliant songwriting and production team, and the incredible unparalleled Funk Brothers playing the backup instrumentation. But the Supremes themselves were the stars. They were the ones doing the TV appearances and singing the songs and became icons. I mean, I can remember as a kid reading Mad Magazine, and there would be, you know, caricatures of the Supremes right up there with Liz Taylor and, you know, Richard Burton and everybody else. They were big, big, big. And as you say in the introduction, that Flo's story has a hopeful beginning, a bright triumph, and a tragic end. Tell us a little bit about the hopeful beginning of her story and her life. Where did she come from? Where were her people from? How did she get into music?
Well, her parents were from Mississippi. They immigrated north in order to escape segregation, or at least nasty segregation, and to work in the Detroit auto plants, which always needed workers because it was hard work. But on the other hand, it was very well paid, and it wasn't as discriminatory as working on a cotton farm somewhere in the South. It was a much better work environment. So her parents basically migrated from Southern states, met in Detroit, and they had, I believe it was
13 children. Up,
but I think it was,
I was 13. 13, yeah. 13. She was number 8.
Yeah. So, and they lived in genteel poverty. I mean, there were housing projects. In fact, the Detroit housing projects were quite good at the time. So they were all supported while living in the housing project by the one man, the father, who worked in an auto plant. And it was a secure kind of existence. So, and now I forgot the question you asked me. What was
Just her beginnings and how she got into music. There was a story in the book, I don't know if you remember, of the family being harassed by a racist white neighbor, and another white neighbor actually stood up for them. Do you remember that story?
Yes, yeah, absolutely. Yes. Flo was holding one of her infant sisters in her arms, and a white boy from nearby started throwing stones at the, or pebbles or stones at them. And Flo protected the baby, but then gave the baby to another one of her siblings and ran after the boy. And the boy's father saw what he thought was happening and ran out and started screaming at Flo and using all sorts of racial epithets. And meanwhile, another white guy who saw the beginning of this incident rushed over and told the guy to shut up. And then when he wouldn't, he knocked him out. So that was a pretty good kind of synopsis of Flo's life in Detroit. She was, you know, assailed to a certain extent by racism, but protected by sympathetic white people, which really says a lot about her rise in the society at the time. The high schools were pretty good too, and they even the black high schools, and they taught music very well. So she learned a lot in that environment also.
And let's go ahead and hear our next song. This is one of the Supremes' early singles. This is during a period when they were known as the no-hit Supremes. This is Buttered Popcorn with Flo on lead vocals. And it was actually written by Barney Ailes, who was Berry Gordon's right-hand man on the business side, and a white Italian-American who made Motown, did a lot to make Motown the business success that it was. This is Buttered Popcorn by the Supremes. And that was Buttered Popcorn by the Supremes, an early single that was released by Motown but not promoted heavily. And it's one of those coulda, woulda, shoulda moments that if the song had been promoted well and had been a hit, it would have been an entirely different story for Flo Ballard. But as it was, then Diane, later Diana Ross, became the lead vocalist of the band. Tell us about the start of the group. How did Flo start this thing? Because she started it single-handedly. She had auditioned for people, and she was the only one auditioning and was then sent out to find other girls who could sing as well.
Let me mention that Buttered Popcorn thing, since you brought it up. I think if you listen to it, which your listeners just did, you can hear the power of Flo's voice at her performance. It was really good. It was amazing that Diana, people used to laugh at Diana in the studio because it sounded like she was singing through her nose. You know, they try to control herself, but she'd be doing these nasal songs, and everyone would laugh at her. So it was really amazing that Diana got out ahead of the game. What did you just ask me again? I forgot.
I was asking you how Flo Ballard came to form the Primettes, later the Supremes.
Oh, yes. Well, there were a lot of, you know, Detroit was really a musical melting or heating pot, whatever you want to call it. The scene was boiling. There were a lot of black and white people who were making fairly good money in the auto industry, and they wanted to do things outside the home at night, you know, and they'd go to clubs and listen to live music. So there were a lot of opportunities for black and white groups to make their start. And when Flo formed the Supremes with a couple of other girls, they were very popular at the clubs. And finally, someone suggested that they go in and audition for Motown. And they did go in, and almost immediately, not almost immediately, Berry Gordy, the manager of Motown, the owner, told them that they were too young to come back. There was something about them that he didn't like. So they made some other records for some other companies. Gradually, their skill increased, and Gordy invited them back and made them recording stars for Motown.
Yeah, and it's fascinating. It's very much like I've heard a lot of people compare Flo Ballard to Brian Jones of the Rolling Stones, and that both of them formed the group, selected the members, and named the group. And both of them were pushed aside and came to early and bad ends. But the big difference between Flo Ballard and Brian Jones is that Brian Jones was demonstrably, and this is kind of unfair to say, but well, hard to say, demonstrably a monster, essentially, who did awful things to people on many, many occasions. And I'm a big Brian Jones fan, but I'm not going to sugarcoat it, that he brought his own end upon himself. But Flo Ballard doesn't have that kind of reputation at all. People love this woman. Why was she squeezed out? Why was she not favored by Motown's leadership?
That's a very good question. I think it's because Diana was very ambitious and also thinner than Flo, and she was attractive, I think, to lots of people, more attractive than Flo. She managed to make herself the leader of the group, basically, and somewhat without being noticed, gradually shoving Flo to the side. She does have a nice singing voice, as you could, anybody can tell by listening to her. She was much more intent on getting to the top than Flo was. I think Flo just liked singing immensely and wasn't thinking about maneuvering in the group. I mean, Diana was Gordy's secretary for a long time, and they ended up having an affair. Incidentally, there was a Motown stage show, not stage show, but recent production about Motown, which Gordy himself supervised. And in that production, I went to see it. It was on Broadway. There's a scene. I couldn't believe I was watching this. This show was controlled by Gordy. And there's a scene in which Gordy and Diana are in bed on stage, and Gordy can't perform. You know,
wow.
I was thinking, Gordy was in charge of this. You know, if this had happened to me, if I wasn't going to put it on stage in a musical about my life. So he's a very odd guy, and it shows Gordy, you know, apologizing. I can't really do it. And Diana saying, well, that's okay. But obviously it did show that they had a sexual relationship. And they certainly did, because Gordy fathered at least one of her children. But then he wouldn't marry her, and she married Robert Silverstein, a white guy who worked for Motown, even though everyone knew, including Silverstein, that the kid was Gordy's. So there's something very weird. There was always something very weird going on there. I just can't figure it out, except Gordy obviously likes women. He's had a lot of girlfriends, I'm not sure he's ever been married, but I guess
he's been married multiple times. Yeah, he's got multiple wives. The second wife was a big part of getting Motown started, and then ended badly when she tried to bootleg some Motown singles. But yeah, now he's.
I'm sorry, I forgot about
that. Yeah, he's. Yeah, so Gordy's definitely been married, but Diana Ross, even before she got entangled with Gordy, was involved with, I believe, Brian Holland of the Holland Dozier Holland production team. So she's just one of these people who followed her heart into directions that were very advantageous for her career at a minimum. Sure. You know, I don't want to engage in like the sexist trope of saying she slept her way to the top, because obviously Diana Ross's vocals were unique. That was the thing, like by going against the grain, like Flo Ballard was sort of a typical R&B powerhouse singer, but Diana Ross had this unique little girl softer voice that Holland Dozier Holland were able to, you know, really channel into these pop hits that went over so well on Ed Sullivan or sounded so great coming on after one of the Beatles' big hits. And so, yeah, it's just one of those questions we'll never really know the answer. But another thing that's interesting is that Flo auditioned initially for a man named Milton Jenkins, who not only discovered her and the Primettes, but he had another group called the Primes, which featured Eddie Kendricks and Paul Williams, and later goes on to be the Temptations. Can you tell us a little bit about this Milton Jenkins character, and how did he form the two most successful singing groups to come out of Detroit in the 1960s and end up with nothing to show for it?
Well, yes, that's a very good question. One of the reasons is that he died fairly early. I mean, he formed those two groups, and he did very well at it. He picked the right people. They did well. But then he wasn't exactly a grasping businessman. He was more like a creative manager. I don't know about the Temptations, but the Supremes had a contract with him. But when they got an offer from Motown, they just ignored it, and he didn't do anything. He didn't go to court or anything. That's what a lot of other people would have done, is say, hey, you got a contract with me. You can't go to Motown. So he was a very forgiving person. He then married one of Flo's sisters, so he couldn't have been that mad. He was a very talented musical entrepreneur, but he wasn't a businessman. A very tight-fisted businessman, which was really what Gordy was and probably is.
Yeah, you don't get to be as wealthy as Berry Gordy by accident, and Milton Jenkins apparently didn't have what it took. Let's take a quick sponsor break. When we come back, we'll talk about the early days of the Supremes at Motown.
Pantheon podcast listeners. Christian Swain here to tell you more about my experience with Raycon earbuds. Our family now has three pairs of Raycon earbuds around the house, and my wife just grabbed a pair of the Headphone Pros to replace some headphones from a company that was double the price. And yes, she loves them. Now, if you haven't pulled the trigger on a pair of Raycons, or even if you have, but you're in the market for another pair because they're just that good, well, now is the time to check them out because they just launched their upgraded model of the best-selling everyday earbuds. With Raycon's upgraded everyday earbuds, now you also get active noise cancellation, ergonomic design, and multi-point connectivity that lets you pair with two devices at once, new quick charge function, three customizable sound styles, plus awareness mode, available in a variety of vibrant new colors to complement any and all skin tones. I even have a pair of earbuds in a cool green color. I have tried just about every earbud known to humankind, and these Raycons are fantastic. Seriously, if you've been wanting to check out Raycons, there truly is no better time. You're going to ask yourself why you didn't check them out sooner, and Raycon offers a 30-day happiness guarantee. So what are you waiting for? Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order, plus free shipping. That's right. You'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon.
Hey folks, Stefan Shirazi and Renee Richardson here from the Metallica Report.
And we are proud members of the Pantheon podcast family, where the best of music and podcasts unite.
We've got something pretty cool for you. We're giving away an exclusive Metallica merch package worth over $250.
That's a whole lot of Scary Guys, Skulls, M72, and other sought-after Metallica swag. And we've made it easy for you to win. Follow and share the Metallica Report, and you're in the game. Go to pantheonpodcast.com/Metallica, enter your email, and hit that button to be entered to win.
And just like that, you're eligible for our monthly exclusive Metallica merch package.
And guess what, rockers? You can enter every month, so just do it. And while we love our global brothers and sisters, the lawyers won't let us ship outside the U.S.
And early on in the Primette's career, there's a horrific incident that happens to Flo when she went to a dance with her brother and got separated from her brother. And then can you tell us the tragic events that occurred at that point?
Yeah, she did get separated from her brother. She wanted to get a lift home, and apparently a basketball star who was there, Reginald Harding, who's now dead, offered her a lift home. Then according to Flo, never told me about it, but her sisters did much later on when I finally wrote the book about her. He apparently raped her, and she didn't tell the police or anything. She didn't tell anyone, but she just went into a major depression, and she wouldn't basically stayed at home for several weeks, wouldn't return phone calls. She was just trying to fight off the the consequences of being raped. And that really set her back. Finally, the other Supremes, that is Diana, Mary Wilson, and the other lady whose name I forgot, lured her out of the house and got her back on the road. But that certainly didn't help her career. And I think it added to her general feeling of being oppressed or depressed by at least parts of society. It didn't help her.
Yeah, definitely not. It's a horrific story. And the Reginald Harding story, I mean, we're so used to hearing stories like that of athletes, elite athletes acting with impunity. But this is decades before the Me Too movement. So, poor Flo had essentially no recourse. And it is interesting that the group did, led by Diane and Mary Wilson, seek her out, and they pulled her out of this depression. So by at least at this point in 62, 63, Diane Ross very much wanted to keep Flo in the group and keep her going. But eventually they do break through. At least they're hanging out at Motown constantly. And they start to get some gigs singing backup. They sing backup for Marvin Gaye, sing backup for Marv Johnson, who was a performer that, along with Jackie Wilson, I mean, Berry Gordy basically made his name writing hit songs and producing hit songs for Jackie Wilson. And then later, Marv Johnson's his second act. that gets big before. I think he had to trade him off to United Artists because Motown didn't have the promotional muscle to promote hit records at that point. But eventually Motown in this period does start having hits on their own label. Smokey Robinson and the Miracles in particular leading the way. Mary Wells is leading the way with some massive hit singles. What was the situation? I mean, who was trying to produce records on the Supremes and why did they not hit?
Gordy was very, he's a very smart businessman. He'd get one group of writers, songwriters, one group of producers, and one group of singers together and try a couple of tunes. And if that group didn't work, if that combination didn't work, it was like three interlocking discs on a machine, actually a machine from an auto factory. And then they'd switch the disc. Then the group would go to the next, the group of singers would go to the next group of writers, you know, and then they'd switch again. The group of singers would go to the next group of writers, the next group of producers. He was trying to find the best possible combination. And as you pointed out, HDH and Smokey Robinson as a producer, and I think I got it right, but I get them mixed up myself. Anyway, he found the right combination that worked with the Supremes, and then they stuck with that combination for quite a long time.
Yeah, it's interesting. Smokey Robinson didn't miss much, but he completely whiffed with the Primettes. After All was the first one, and then a guy named Freddie Gorman wrote a song called I Want a Guy that Diane sang lead on. But yeah, and then they tried Buttered Popcorn with Barney Ellis writing that one, which I believe was his only turn as a songwriter. I could be wrong, but it was the most well-known song that he produced. And it's very interesting. If that thing had hit, it would have taken them in an entirely different direction. It's a flagrantly sexual song.
Yeah.
And would have positioned Flo as this, you know, sex bomb sort of persona. And so, and you know, it was Gordy's decision to not promote that heavily. And then he hands him off to Holland Dozier Holland. And they have hits with, beginning with When the Love Light Starts Shining Through His Eyes. It makes number 23 on the pop charts in the fall of 63. And at that point, they're touring on the Motown Review and then the Dick Clark tour. What was their status on those early tours and how'd they fare?
Let me just mention, I'm glad you mentioned the sexual angle on Buttered Popcorn, because when Gordy heard about that, he hadn't perceived it. When he heard about that, he was shocked. He didn't want to be in the porn business. So that's probably one reason that book wasn't promoted. That song wasn't promoted. What was your next question? I missed.
Well, about the early tours that the Supremes did, first on the Motown Review and then the Dick Clark tour, they were absolutely the opening act as fits the no-hit Supremes. How'd they do on those tours, and how did their status change when they did start to get hits?
Well, as at the beginning of that, the tour that I think you're talking about, they didn't have any hits. So they were the opening number, which is just the warm-up number for the big groups. Then as their first song became very popular, they were moved up slowly in the pecking order or the order of appearance on stage. And, you know, they kept wondering why, because they weren't really in contact with the headquarters in Detroit. So they'd be moved up slowly. And finally, they got near the end. And as soon as they came out, people would be applauding. And they wondered why. And then they realized that something must be happening. So they rushed out. This is pre-cell phone era, obviously. They rushed out and bought copies of Billboard to see where their songs were. And the song they had just recorded had risen to number one. That happened while they were on this month-long tour. It's a very, very different era then, when, you know, you couldn't tell what was happening unless you paid whatever it was, a dollar or two for a magazine, and then found the right page. But yeah, that's what happened. Their songs became more popular, and then they really hit the top. Then they were at the top for several years.
Yeah, Where Did Our Love Go happens on that first Dick Clark tour. And it's interesting. I've read numerous accounts of both white and black acts that toured with Dick Clark. And Dick Clark actually, you know, has a mixed reputation for his various business. maneuvers, and for some people see him as a bland, somebody who blanded rock and roll and was kind of the opposite of Alan Freed. But everyone consistently says that he treated all the acts on his tours equally well, and that he did his best to protect black acts from the vicious segregation that was going on in the South. And so that touring with Dick Clark was very much an esprit de corps and a team spirit that the Supremes plugged into very well. But then, you know, once they're big, they just stay big. Tell us about their breakthrough with Ed Sullivan. Actually, Steph tells me it's time to cue, so let me cue one more. This is Ain't That Good News, from a tribute album to Sam Cooke that the Supremes recorded, and this is one of the few songs that Flo Ballard got to sing lead on. Ain't That Good News.
Oh, my baby's coming home tomorrow. Ain't that good news? Yeah, ain't that news? My baby's coming home tomorrow. Ain't that news? Yeah, ain't that news? I got a letter just the other day telling me that he was on his way and he wants me to meet it at the station.
And that was the Supremes covering Sam Cooke's Ain't That Good News with Flo Ballard on lead vocals. And you can definitely hear this was an incredibly talented singer, a woman who, had she not been in the shadow of the most successful lead singer on earth, would, you know, virtually anything was possible with that kind of talent and the Motown exposure. But at this point, she's essentially enjoying the ride. I mean, even being the number two singer in the Supremes was a pretty sweet gig. Tell us about their rise and their success on Ed Sullivan and the Copacabana nightclub and their tours of England.
Well, the Ed Sullivan show, you know, it's funny if you watch the, I believe you can still see their original appearance on Ed Sullivan on YouTube, how far TV has come in terms of special effects, because the Supremes are performing on the Ed Sullivan show, which was the premier TV show, certainly the premier TV variety show at the time, and their backdrop, rather than even flashing lights, was like a huge piece of white paper that hung from the ceiling of the stage. And that's what they were, and they had one microphone on a stand. So that's how they were invited to perform. It wasn't that they were being discriminated against, it's just that TV was really in its infancy. I remember seeing that show. I thought they were fantastic. And it was really fantastic because they were black also. This is very unusual to have black women who were, I must say, much different than the previous black female stars. The previous black female stars were like Big Mama Thornton. You know, they were overweight, very soulful. They sang slow, depressing songs. They were great musicians, but the Supremes, which fit in with what was happening with the integration in society, the Supremes fit in with what, you know, what was going on. Everything was getting lighter in all senses. You know, it was easier to mix with people. This is all before the Detroit riot of 68, which put a damper on it. But the whole thing was just a very light, progressive upsurge of interracial harmony in all senses of the word.
Yeah, and to be fair, they did build on the work that had come out of the Brill Building with groups like the Shirelles and the Chiffons and others who were you know, singing songs by Goffin and King and others. So it wasn't just out of the blue. And the Marvelettes obviously had hit for Motown as well, but the magnitude of their stardom none of those other acts. I mean, I think the Supremes were second only to the Dave Clark Five in terms of number of appearances on the Ed Sullivan show in the 1960s. And there's no way in 2023 to comprehend how big Ed Sullivan was. I mean, famously 73 million people tuned in to see the Beatles on Ed Sullivan in February of 1964, but he would consistently do numbers in the 20s and 30 million viewers week in, week out. And it's just impossible to comprehend how big a deal it was for the Supremes to basically become regulars on the most popular show, not just the most popular show at the time, but the most popular show in the history of American television. So they ascended to this rarefied, you know, superstar status. And then they play the Copacabana. And the Copa is this famous nightclub you know, infamously partly owned by the Genovese family. I think Frank Costello was one of the original owners before he was shot in the head by the Chin Gigante and retired from the business. But, you know, Sam Cooke had famously flopped at the Copacabana. Elvis never even tried to play the Copacabana. What was it about the Supremes? How did they succeed with that nightclub audience?
Well, they did very well there. It was very surprising. I think it was because they were basically dainty and polite young ladies. I mean, they sang songs, but they were dressed like proper young women, and they sang songs that didn't have any, or very rarely had any sexual overtones. And they were nice people. You know, they fit in at the Copa. One thing about that club is I don't believe there was a stage, or if there was, they didn't use it. So the Supremes were standing right in among the tables at one end of the dining tables at one end of the club. So you couldn't actually have a riotous singer there, because he or she would kick over a table or destroy someone's cocktail. They were polite. They were polite young ladies, while they were great performers. And you know, there's probably a visceral fear that white people have, or had, or maybe they still have it, about black performers being sort of madmen or madwomen, like maybe Tina Turner or a lot of the black male guys. They jump all over the place. You know, you wouldn't want them near one of your expensive cocktails. But the Supremes, you knew they weren't going to upset anything.
Yeah, they weren't going to be doing the leaping splits like Jackie Wilson or James Brown onto people's cocktail tables. So they fit in very well. But this is the time period when flow starts to get pushed to one side, where she's getting fewer and fewer lead vocals. Songs that she had sung lead on in rehearsal then are given to Diana Ross. In particular, House of the Rising Sun, the cover of the Animals' massive hit, was given to Diana Ross. And Diana starts making jokes about Flo on stage and calling her fat and various things. How did Flo react to that? What was her counter move?
Well, that's her problem. She didn't really have any counter move. She just absorbed it and got more and more depressed. I don't want to compare it to the rape that had happened earlier, but that was her defense, I think, to just sort of enfold herself and be dignified and not strike back. Mary Wilson also didn't respond to any of that. There was a famous scene in which, this is between Mary Wilson and Diana Ross, where Diana's at one club or one appearance, Diana Ross's mic suddenly failed. So she grabbed the mic out of Mary Wilson's hand and started singing in it. Mary, although she didn't cause a fuss, grabbed the mic back, and then Diana grabbed it back from her. So they were basically, without saying anything, they were catfighting on stage. That was kind of the person Diana is, and Flo just probably would have just stood there. You know, she wasn't the combative type. She just absorbed the blows and tried to go on. That was one of her problems.
And so let's hear our final song, and then we'll talk about her forced departure from the group and her downfall. This is Love Ain't Love. This is from Flo Ballard's solo career on ABC Records. And that was Love Ain't Love by Florence Ballard solo on ABC Records after she had been squeezed out of the Supremes. So tell us, Peter, how did that squeeze happen? How was she forced from the group? And was there a warning? Was there a decline in her behavior? Did she act out? Why did the Motown make such a big move to disrupt their most successful act?
That's a very good question. I really think that Diane, you know, first of all, let me say that Mary Wilson was used to being a non-player in all this stuff. She just kept very quiet. She had been transferred from one family to another during her growing up period, and just learned to keep her, you know, learned to keep her mouth shut. And she'd done very well by doing that, and that's what she kept on doing. She saw that Diane was trying to get Flo out of the group, but she wouldn't say anything. She wouldn't support either of them, which was probably the right thing to do since she was in the middle. But she didn't help Flo or didn't help Diane. And however, Flo just reacted by getting more and more sullen, and probably less of a flamboyant performer, which made it easier for Diana to finally convince Gordy to kick Flo out of the group. She just became depressed and sullen, something like what happened after she was raped much earlier in her life. So it made it relatively easy for Gordy and Diana to get rid of her. She was also, you know, she was also the main competitor, Diana, so that Mary Wilson wasn't. Diana was afraid of Flo for obvious reasons, because Flo was very talented. Mary Wilson was a great backup singer, but Flo was the real competition, and Diana wanted Flo out of there.
And so when she is kicked out of the group, she does hire lawyers and actually receives a six-figure settlement, but hardly any of the money ended up in her pockets. What happened? How did she end up in that situation?
Well, that was her. Then the worst aspect of her personality came out. People would give papers to her to sign, and she just signed them without reading them. So the settlement that she got was much less than she should have gotten. And then the lawyer that she hired, she had a hard time getting a lawyer. The lawyer that she hired, stole the money, basically. He must have seen that he certainly couldn't have been a great guy, but he must have also seen that she was not the fighter type, and that she just, you know, sulk or feel bad. So he stole probably 98% of the money that Motown had given her. Now, it was a bad settlement to start with. It didn't include any of the royalties on the songs, you know, any future royalties. But future royalties on the Supreme songs when Flo was fired were stupendous. You know, the songs were recorded and re-recorded year after year after year. Flo should have been very rich. I mean, Mary Wilson hung on with the group and was making in the 70s, $80,000 a year just from royalties, which was quite an amount at the time. But basically, lots of people saw the opportunity to just, you know, treat Flo badly monetarily, because she just got disgusted and would sign anything. And so they stole all the money from her, and she was left in poverty.
And tell us about her attempted solo career with ABC Records. Who was producing her, and how did that go? And how did it, you know, why did it not go further than it did?
Well, possibly because she had married Tommy, her husband, her only marriage, and he wasn't particularly talented. He had been Gordy's chauffeur, and so he wasn't really in the record business in any real sense. And then he signed her up BC Records, but they didn't really know what to do with her. They didn't have any of the talent that Motown had in songwriting and so on. So when her first, Motown had also prevented her from calling herself a former Supreme. Now that would have been, I think, a very helpful thing to do. You know, the radio stations, et cetera, would have gone wild. New album by former Supreme Florence Ballard. You know, she was kicked out of Supremes, and now she's back. Flo Ballard with, you know, I'm Climbing the Mountain or something like that. But nothing. They signed only agreement. Motown forced them not to ever say that she was going to be a Supreme again. And he had been a Supreme. So all these opportunities were lost. ABC didn't know what to do with her. And they just dropped her after her only solo album was a failure. I think her mood of discouragement certainly infected them, but they also could have had better managers. Her Tommy Chapman, who she married, was her manager, but he was not a professional. If she had married someone else or just gotten a separate manager who had any gumption, he would have tried to get her to form another group, the New Supremes or something, or indicate that it was a competing group for the Supremes with women who looked like Mary and Diana, you know, something like that. It would have gotten some attention, but they didn't do anything. They just let her career die.
And then she reaches the point we discussed at the beginning where she's actually on assistance to help with her dependent children. And you helped publicize that, which drew quite a bit of attention. And she did get a little bit of public shine. Like, she got to sing at some benefit performances in her final days. Tell us about those. Like, she did get a tiny bit of glory in some live events towards the end.
Yeah, she did. With various other female singers and other companies were sympathetic to her. They knew what a talented person she was and how depressed she was at being thrown out of the Supremes. I mean, she'd gone from basically, you know, nothing to the very top and then down to the bottom again. It's like a horrible roller coaster or parachute jump in only a few years. I mean, it would have traumatized everybody, and it really did with her, coupled with the rape and her general what had become general attitude toward life. But no, you know, she sang in a few concerts. People applauded her wildly. That is, the audience applauded her wildly, but nothing really came of it. And then she had three children. Then she got divorced, and then she died. It was like she never really recovered from the from the blow, the original blow of being forced out of the world's most popular female singing group.
Yeah, and that's a blow, you know, almost anybody would have trouble recovering from. Brian Jones, for his part, certainly never recovered from being kicked out of the Rolling Stones. But, you know, unlike Flo, he had rendered himself useless, you know, breaking his hand, trying to punch girlfriends and things like that. So he couldn't even play guitar by the end, whereas Flo apparently kept her chops to the end. And her death at age 32 from heart disease makes me think of Mama Cass Elliot, who was also 32 years old when she died of a heart attack. So, and both of them, you know, you do mention that Flo had drunk heavily, especially in the period right after being kicked out of the Supremes. So that couldn't have helped. But nonetheless, just an immensely tragic loss, and somebody who brought the world, has brought millions and millions of people so much joy through the group that she created, the Supremes. So I'm so happy, Peter, that you were able to come on the show and we could help honor the memory of Florence Ballard. My guest has been Peter Benjamin. The book is The Lost Supreme, The Life of Dream Girl Florence Ballard. So here's to you, Flo. Thanks, Peter.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Follow the Let It Roll podcast on Twitter at Let It Roll Cast, and check out our website at letitrollpodcast.com. Monday, Nate welcomes Pat Slashel to discuss his book, Texas is the Reason, The Mavericks of Lone Star Punk. Let It Roll is a Pantheon podcast, and you can listen to more great podcasts at www.pantheonpodcast.com.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's fantasypoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. Fantasypoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.